Good evening. We are now in our sixth session of the White House Communications course. One of the new things that we have added is that if you're watching it on video stream live, if you want to ask a question, this is the way that you can do it. You can email your question to Mike Corsi, who is in the classroom at Towson. And the email address is TU, for Towson University, 475, which is the number of the course, at Towson, TOWSON.edu. That's TU 475 at Towson.edu. And this evening, it's a pleasure to have with us Elizabeth Buemiller, who is a correspondent at the White House for the New York Times. Elizabeth has worked for the Times and also for the Washington Post, and she brings to her beat a broad experience covering not just other institutions in Washington, but also throughout the world, because she has spent time as a correspondent in Tokyo and also in New Delhi. And she has written about women in families in both countries. So she brings a lot more than just a political understanding of the White House as an institution. And I think, Elizabeth, is a place to start. Helen Thomas, when she was here, was talking about how important the press is as a surrogate for the public. What is your view of where the press comes in a representative system?
Well, not surprisingly, I think the press is really important. I think that, we can talk about what the White House thinks of the press, but from what I think is that we play a really important role in trying to ferret out what's really going on in the government. Every day the White House puts out announcements and the president makes speeches, but that's only one part of the story. And my role is to dig underneath the official pronouncements and speeches and press conferences and try and tell Americans, or at least my readers, a million readers during the week and 2 million on Sunday, what is the motivation? What is the White House really doing? What are our elected leaders really doing behind the public facade? It's a hard job. It's hard to actually find out in this White House.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the ways in which they're uncooperative in providing the kind of information that you would like?
And I would say almost in all ways. This is a tough White House. I'm sure you've heard this if you've heard from other reporters who cover this White House. It's one of the I've been in and out of Washington over the last 20 years. I worked for the Washington Post during the first term of Reagan, and so you can't just say that Republicans are like this, that Republicans aren't real friendly with the press. This White House is extraordinary. Everything is controlled. They're very disciplined. I mean, they get together in the morning and they have sort of a message meeting, and that's going to be their message of the day. So, at least publicly, no matter what question you ask of any member of the administration, you're going to get the same response down to the same phrasing. I mean, Scott McClellan did it today at the White House, at the early White House briefing. We were all asking Scott, did the administration or did the White House view the vote in Spain, which, as you all know, that the people of Spain elected a socialist government and threw out the government of that was friendly to the Bush administration after the bombings. And so we all asked Scott, five different ways, did he think this was a problem for the White House, and did he think that the voters were trying to send a message? And Scott never answered the question. He just reverted every time to his talking points and his plan statement, which was that terrorism is a terrible thing, and you can do any kind of political analysis you want, but terrorism is terrible, and we will not let it defeat us. And so it's very frustrating.
Do you think, to some extent, if you look back, Republican administrations have that they have that that type of pattern, that when you look at their operations, they're organized for communications. They're organized towards persuasion rather than for providing information, so that often the press secretary is responsible to the communications director, and that they're focusing on their plan, like they plan, say, 3 to 4 months out, and they want to talk about what they want to talk about. But that's it. I mean, that was true with Nixon planned out. The Reagan people also planned, and they put people in the press position, in the press secretary's position, whose job it was basically to say what they, that message that they had developed.
Right, but the Reagan, that's absolutely true, and I think that's true of Republican administrations, but the Reagan administration, they were fabulous leakers. I mean, yeah, the Larry Speaks, who was press secretary for the first term, for most of the first term when I was in town, should I look at you, or who do I look at? I'm confused now. What's the best look at the TV screen, or I look
at, we can talk, okay. And then when we get the questions.
Look up there, okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I look up there. Yeah. They, you know, Larry Speaks, the press secretary, would go out with the line of the day. But the great thing about the Reagan administration was that they all leaked wildly and madly, you know, during the day. I mean, if from Jim Baker to David Gergen to the, you know, from the White House chief of staff to the deputy chief of staff to all sorts of other people at the White House, they would talk to us about what was really going on. And that doesn't happen here. The president has hired an extraordinary group of people who are intensely loyal and intensely disciplined. And there's just very little that comes out of this White House that isn't, that they don't want out. So it's hard as a reporter.
And I guess Baker thought that it was important for reporters to have an understanding of policy. And
right.
So he did a lot of background briefing because of that.
Right. And there's very little two things. There's very little explanation of policy in this White House. I mean, if you read some of the books that have come out, the very beginning of these sort of tell-all books by former members of the administration, they say that there's like no policy going on. It's all the political shop and the communication shop that are running things. And there's an appalling shallowness about policy. That's at least what, you know, former Treasury Secretary O'Neill said, Paul O'Neill. The other thing, so, I mean, you can argue the other way. I mean, because I think there are a few members of the White House who you can talk policy with, but it's hard to do it. I mean, they have to get permission. The other thing is that I think there's a real aversion in this White House to talking about anything human about President Bush. The president doesn't like it. And I struggle with this all the time because the stuff I write is often more, you know, personal and more connected to Bush the man. And they just hate that stuff because the president hates it for whatever reason, even if it's, you know, positive. So I think, but as a result of their communications policy, the public, and I don't get a sense, or I get not enough sense that I want, and the public doesn't get a sense of how Bush acts as president. You know, he's a much more engaged, active president than a lot of the public thinks. But there's so little of that comes out because it's such a rigid, you know, message every day. That's I think it hurts them in that way. They wouldn't agree with that, but that's what I think.
And also perhaps it hurts them at the margins because reporters don't trust them for the information that they get from them because they give so little of it. So if the White House wants to say, you know, trust us, we're going to give you things, they don't have a history. Like, say, with the National Guard, the president had said in his Russert interview that he would give information about his National Guard days, and it took until Friday to get that information.
Wow.
And in between, Scott McClellan got beaten up in the gaggle in the briefing every day.
Well, that was a mess. I would say, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that my issue, I don't know of any incident when I've been outright lied to. I mean, I don't. That's not my issue. My issue is mostly that you can never get them off the talking points. I mean, they just you can't engage them intellectually in a way that is helpful to my stories, you know, or to helpful to the readers, and that's really frustrating. I think on the National Guard, that was a whole other mess. The president sort of just said in this interview, okay, I want everything out. I think I would give them the benefit of the doubt of, I would give them that they didn't know what was out there, and then they spent a whole week just getting all that stuff out of, it all came out of Colorado. Scott said at one point in the briefing, you heard him, we're only going to give out stuff related to his record, you know, Scott pulled back for a couple days and then they came out again, and it was kind of, they were in a mess on that, but I think it was because Scott made some little missteps maybe, and also, they didn't, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. They didn't know what they had coming out of Colorado, and then what came out really didn't help very much.
Do you think that a communications operation that's geared towards developing a plan and developing a message, that one of the inherent problems it has is stopping and listening, that it's hard to listen, that that sometimes you can miss things that are coming up because everybody has a job and their job is to carry that message forward, and that sometimes that it's hard.
Yeah, I think that's what's happening now with the Kerry campaign a little bit. The White House is I sometimes feel like the New York Times is like this too. It's this big battleship and it's very hard to turn around on a dime.
Yeah.
And the Kerry campaign right now is lean and mean, and they've got really good people for the sort of the best of the Democratic Party working now for that campaign, and they're young and they're just completely focused and energized, and they're just slamming this stuff out about Bush, you know, six times a day. And the White House is a little slow because, I mean, I think they're getting better. It's only been a couple of weeks now, but the last, they really, they develop their plan early in the morning, but then it changes all day long, and they're real slow to come back. I mean, they really got undercut last week when the president was, this has been written about, but it was, I mean, the president was all set to announce his new job czar, you know, this new guy who was going to, you know, create jobs in America. He announced on Labor Day that, okay, we're going to have a job czar, and then he had a big plan to announce this guy on Thursday, and this guy was actually in town on Wednesday night ready for his press conference on Thursday. Well, the Kerry campaign got wind of this and completely undercut the president and just announced that this guy was going to be announced and said, and guess what, you know, he's an outsourcer. He's laid off American workers and he's opened up a factory in China. And by, you know, 24 hours later, this guy had, you know, no job in Washington.
Yeah.
I mean, they really, that was pretty good guerrilla warfare, I would say.
But they would have been just a little bit more clever if they hadn't said anything until he was formally announced, because he never was formally announced. And they could have, you know.
Oh, the Kerry campaign,
right,
you mean?
Yeah, yeah. If they just had held back until the name actually came out, the White House sent it up to the Hill.
But this was more effective, I think, because the guy didn't get named, and now there's no job czar.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So now there's the position is still empty, and it just showed that they could back the White House into a corner if they had. I mean, I guess you're right. You could go either way.
Yeah.
But if they'd waited, and then they would have just said, "Oh well," I mean, I was amazed the White House caved on that. But they also said it was because this guy who's from Nebraska is that Senator Chuck Hagel had problems with him. So I don't know.
Uh huh.
It was a pretty good mess, though.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult to get to switch from a governing mode to getting into a campaign, because the cycle runs so much faster.
Right, and the other thing about the White House is for the last 3 years, they have been the big banana. You know, this is, you know, I mean, I think they're still recovering from, they're still learning that they're going to have to deal with Kerry every day. I mean, for a long time, Bush has been the most important politician in the land. He still is, of course. But, you know, for a long time it was, well, how can you say that about the president? You know, he's the president. There's this indignation. And I think now they're beginning to realize, hey, he's also a political candidate in addition to being president.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I thought I would go back and give you a comparison from early in the 20th century of a reporter who covered the White House. He's generally thought of as one of the first White House reporters, William Price, who was one of the organizers of the White House Correspondents Association. And in 1902, when the Washington, the Evening Star had its 50th anniversary, everybody wrote about their beat and how it had changed. And he talked about how he gets information from the White House, and this is 1902. As a matter of fact, the news secured at the White House is nearly always the result of the efforts of the newspaper men themselves. It is generally not the policy of either the president or his secretary to make public any information. A hint of a story must be found before either will talk. Appointments and similar official changes are made public, but there's no giving out of prepared news. So reporters and correspondents have to find it themselves. And so what they then do is get a tip, or the same friends develop the story for them, and sometimes it's a question of hard digging, as the miner puts it, to unravel the story. And you were talking about digging, too.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that, because, you know, I was thinking the good old days, and it was Teddy Roosevelt was president, right? 1902,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
Yeah, in the good old days, you always imagine that, you know, the president was just calling reporters into the Oval Office. You know, you see these pictures in the West Wing lobby, and you think, God, isn't that amazing? You know, there are the reporters all just hanging out in the Oval Office, and so that's nice to hear that it wasn't that great, you know.
Yeah, and Roosevelt did talk to reporters, but yeah. He had in those people he wanted. And if you displeased him in some way, then you were not allowed to come in. And so Price talks about getting tips. And he said, you know, he might have gotten the same story that the president gave him, but he was to have off the record. He might have gotten it some other way, but he felt he couldn't use it because the president would think that he was breaking a confidence and he couldn't run that risk. So they were always worried about what their relationships were. But they did get those off-the-record sessions. Dan Bartlett last week was talking about off-the-record sessions and that he wanted to have sessions with the president so that people would get to know him as a person. But it's difficult to keep those on the off the record, as the recent session with five television correspondence from all the networks. What do you think of those kinds of sessions? Have you had one yourself?
We have not. So far, it's only been with the networks. There's talk of one with the newspapers. I mean, it's a mixed bag for us. I mean, in previous administrations, I think when Reagan, I can remember, the New York Times boycotted one of these sessions and said, if it's not on the record, we're not going. Well, you know, I think you should go because you find stuff out. And unlike this reporter, I mean, if the president said something and then I could chase around and get it someplace else, I would use it, of course. So I think, and you get an insight into the president. I don't know what the problem with, I don't know what, so I think they're basically useful, but you can get yourself tied into a bind. And the other thing is, especially now, there's no off the record in Washington. And so I don't really think the president is going to totally level with the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal, whatever they would have in there for this off the record session. You know, I don't think any intelligent person would ever really tell us something terrific and, you know, truthful. I mean, I mean, I'm just saying, I don't think the president's still going to be really careful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's unrealistic in a way, because reporters are then going to go out and talk to each other.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if news is committed, like, say, during the Clinton administration, when the president had an off-the-record session with a group of reporters in Austin and talked about the earning power that Hillary Clinton would have. How many $1 million she would be able to earn. There was a financial analysis, and he said if she didn't run for the Senate, you know, this financial analysis said she would earn, I think it was $20 million. And I can't remember, you know, it was a five-year period.
Yeah.
So that ended up, of course, ended up in the news. Nobody in that session used it, but several people gave it to a reporter, to Ken Bazinet, who then did use it in the New York Daily News. So it does seem unrealistic.
Right.
That nothing is really off the record. What do you find are the advantages of being at the White House, of the White House beat? What do you like about it? What are the disadvantages?
Let's see.
I think we've gotten a few of the disadvantages.
What are the advantages? Let's see. Should I just look at you now? Or
either,
I don't know. I'll look at you.
Doesn't make any difference.
What are the advantages? Well, it's a big deal. You know, I mean, it's you're in the center. You're absolutely in the center of things. Everything I write about is almost everything is important. Most of it is interesting. About 30% of it is absolutely riveting. I mm-hmm. feel like I've engaged on the really big issues of the country, you know, in the world. Some of it's very exciting, you know, the foreign travel. And I, mm-hmm. you know, I was in Aqaba in Jordan when there was the summit between, mm-hmm. That now is fallen to pieces, yeah. but it seemed very important at the time last June when we yeah. were all there and the Bush thought he was making peace in the Middle East, you know, another president led down that path. So I like that part of it. It's a funny thing to say. I don't work at the White House. The New York Times Bureau, Washington Bureau is a few blocks away, just on the other side of Lafayette Park, but I'm at the White House a lot. And it's a funny thing to say, I like being at the White House. I think I love it as a building, and as mm-hmm. it's a very beautiful, interesting place to be. Mm-hmm. It's a funny thing. I like walking in there in the mornings. It's mm-hmm. always pretty and it's always interesting. And I like it the White House is as an institution, as a home, as a museum, you know, as a somewhat public place, as a workplace is fascinating. You know, I find that really interesting, you know, this sort of upstairs, downstairs aspect of it, plus the fact that it's so small, you know, really. And it's got, there's such stories in that building, and I go there almost mm-hmm. every day, you know. That's what I like about it, I guess. Am I leaving anything else? I can't think of anything else. There's a lot of downsides.
I was just thinking that when you walk into it and you're thinking about the White House as a whole, so mm-hmm. in a way you're thinking about more than the president. Is that something of a reminder that your beat is more than just covering the president?
Sure.
But that it's covering the institution of the presidency and covering the staff.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. Because it's a big broad beat. You know, when you go back, and I was just reading about previous presidential elections, you know, I did this piece over the weekend for the Week in Review on negative campaigning, and they've been negative for 200 years, and this one is like nothing yet. Forget it. This is like, you know, kindergarten. But when you go back and you read about this stuff and you realize this is a great thing to cover. I mean, this is interesting. And also when you walk into the East Room and you realize, I think that's where Lincoln laid in state, mm-hmm. and you think about just this country. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to cover. You step back, on a lot of days it's completely agonizing and maddening and frustrating.
It's true. I was thinking on the East Room, that's the place where President Jefferson talked to Meriwether Lewis.
Right, and that's I think
Meriwether teaching him.
That was where Meriwether Lewis had. I think they had split it up into some offices mm-hmm. for Meriwether Lewis. I mean, think about that. I walk in there a lot, you know, and that's amazing, you know.
Yeah.
And I guess, so I like that part of it.
Uh huh. What are some of the downsides?
Well, those are a lot. I mean, the downsides are that you're in a very you're in the bubble. It's very hard to do anything original, and you're on a very short leash with the office. I mean, in terms of being original, it's very easy to be a mediocre White House correspondent. It is very hard to be a good one, because in terms of being, it's easy because there's a lot of sort of given page one stories. You know, the president hiccups, and it's often on page one, especially after 9/11. You know, you can cover a presidential speech, and you don't have to do a particularly good job, and it lands right on as the lead of the paper. You know, unlike this, the reporter during Roosevelt's day, there is a lot of news they kind of hand out, and you can just put it in the paper. And you're in the paper a lot and it looks like you're doing an okay job. I mean, not at the New York Times. They don't think that's an okay job. But so that's a downside. It's just it's so constricted. And you can't I sometimes feel like I miss being a reporter, you know, because you can't wander loose in the West Wing. You know, mm-hmm. we're restricted, as you know, to the press office and just up to the press secretary's office. You can't wander loose in the White House. It's very hard to get real stuff out of people, you know, in the White House. And so you go to the Hill and you go to look for, you know, it's just a hard beat to be distinctive in and to do to control, really.
Uh-huh. How do you come up with the kinds of things that you do? Because you have a mixture of enterprise and of daily reporting.
Right.
How do you come up with them? There are three of you that cover the beat.
Well, we just, I don't know, it's kind of a fairly informal. I mean, David Sanger covers more foreign policy, and he covers really national security. Mm-hmm. He covers, and I tend, and there was just two of us for a while, and now we added a third because it became overwhelming. And then Dick and I do more politics and domestic stuff, although we do the foreign trips. You know, if you come up with an idea, it's yours, and then you do it. A lot of times they come out of New York, out of the editors in New York. I'm working on a story idea now that came straight from the editor in New York, so that has to get done immediately. You know, mm-hmm. they tend to get higher priority than the others, than your ideas. A lot of times it's just, you know, serendipity. I mean, I did a story in the Today's paper about President Bush time, presidential time, right. And I got that idea last week sitting at I have to write those every Monday, so I'm always thinking about what am I going to do. But I got that idea sitting at the briefing last Tuesday when there was a back and forth about, there was a lot of very contentious questions from the reporters to Scott about would the president testify to the 9/11 commission, mm-hmm. and would he go more than an hour, you know? And Scott said, well, he said he's going to testify for an hour, but he's going to answer all the questions. And he couldn't, here's an example of the message of the day. Scott could not, you know, it took 45 minutes to get, Scott said, he's only going to testify for an hour, but he's going to answer all the questions. And we said, Scott, you can't have it both ways. And we went back and forth and around, and we got nowhere. But during that around and around, I started thinking about time. How does the president use his time? Because it was this big thing. This is an hour out of the president's day. This is a very big deal. And that's when I got and of course, John Kerry had said, which had prompted the whole thing, if the president has time to go to a rodeo, he should have more time than just an hour for the 9/11 commission.
Yeah. It was a very interesting piece in your discussion about his meetings. And I was wondering, in looking at the way they use time, as to what they use it for. What are those meetings for? What role do meetings play for him as far as the decisions that he makes?
A lot of different things. I can tell you, let's see, things I know specifically, like on when they were on Medicare, the Medicare bill and the prescription drug bill last fall, I talked. The role for meetings for this president, because they're never more than 45 minutes, is to get a quick update from the staff on where we are in a certain issue, let's say prescription drugs, okay, or mm-hmm. Medicare, of some bill on the Hill. And boom, 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 you got to come in. And everyone I've talked to says the same thing. You know, this Paula Neal aside, that's another issue, that's cabinet meetings. But and these sort of smaller meetings in the Oval Office with a small the role, everyone goes around and presents, okay, here's where we are, here's where we are on the Hill, here's where we are with this group, here's where we are with that group. And the president, you know, moves in very quickly to find out, and I've seen him do this, he zeroes in and gets the piece of information he needs out of the person. And the person will have a 15-minute prepared presentation to Bush, but he'll uh-huh. be interrupted right away. And then Bush will make a decision very quickly after listening to all this about, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're now going to, I want you to do this, this, and this, and I want it done tomorrow. You know, and so it's more of a CEO kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of discussion about ideas or maybe we should do this, maybe we should do that. I mean, that probably goes on earlier. But the ones that I've seen, it's moving toward getting information quickly and then moving toward action based on the information.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of, he's very decisive. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of second guessing or what about this, what about that.
Uh-huh. How does it compare, for example, during the Reagan period, were you able to get some sense of how Reagan made decisions?
You know, I didn't
role in meetings?
That's a really good question. I didn't cover Reagan. I was a reporter for the, I mean, I covered him to the extent that I covered the administration. I was a style section reporter for the Washington Post, and I did a lot of profiles of White House officials, mm-hmm. and you know, like Deaver and, you know,
Larry Speaks, I remember reading.
Yeah, Speaks and stuff. Speaks. And so I didn't really cover that part of the White House. And I don't know the answer to that. Do you know the answer? Do you have any idea?
No, I can't say.
I mean, I think he was less engaged, but that, I'm not sure. That was the view. I don't know if I know it myself.
The meetings were longer, and maybe there's more information that was coming up in them, because most political people seem to like to get information verbally.
A
lot of them do. Carter didn't, but Clinton seems to, because they are people who, as politicians, enjoy dealing with other people.
Not
necessarily reading.
Yeah.
Mark McKinnon, in Ken Auletta's piece, there's a quote from him that's a kicker in the story. the White House press corps is lost in the dust of internet and cable. And I wondered, what do you think of that?
Well, not much. I mean, I saw Mark after that, and I said, you know, I just disagree. Well, obviously, I disagree. I think that we're the totally washed up White House press corps. I mean, that's been said about the White House press corps for a long time.
Since probably William Price's time.
Yeah, right. But I have to tell you, I mean, this is going to seem a little arrogant, but I think. I don't feel that working for the New York Times that I'm irrelevant or washed up or in the dustbin. You know, I feel like what I write gets, you know, raked over with a fine-tooth comb by this White House. They certainly are reacting to it. You know, not always positively, but you know, I don't feel that myself. I feel like and the letters I get from readers and the email and the phone calls is so intense. I mean, it's just amazing. And I don't feel that at all. I feel like everything I do is read and scrutinized and argued over and complained about, you know, not praised very often. And I also think that quote, I think it probably got Mark a lot of points at the White House. I just don't think
I haven't found anybody at the White House that agreed with it.
Well, the thing is, it's just the article by Ken completely belied what Mark said, because if you look at what they actually do all day, they spend an awful lot of time worrying about what's in the press. The morning the senior staff meeting at 7:30 is all about, well, what's in the papers. Plus, we talked about that giant, you know, the giant White House clipping service they get. Plus, after the 7:30 staff meeting, there's a whole communications meeting about how we're going to deal with the press. I mean, the whole thing. Well, that's good that people at the White House didn't agree with it. Because
last week, Dan talked about the importance of the New York Times.
Oh, well, I'd love to hear what he said, because they're always complaining about us.
Well, they take you very seriously, not only for what you do, but for the way that you move news elsewhere.
Yeah.
And so that he was talking about the importance of the Times in setting the agenda for the television networks.
Right.
So that it's not just that, you know, that you're writing to your particular audience of readers, but that you're shaping what television is doing as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if TV might say that, but I certainly know people have said to me that as television has cut back on staffing, that, you know, the newspapers, I won't say just the Times, the Washington Post is certainly in the mix, as is the Journal and the other, you know, national papers, that they use the papers almost as assignment editors in a funny way. I mean, they've got their own, but, you know, it's nice that Dan said that, because, God, did they complain about us.
I mean, when you think about it, it's really the White House press corps that's writing the first cut, the contemporary cut of history, because it is the press corps that is writing about the policy, writing about the presidential actions. they have a lot of interest in the local press corps. But last week, one of the points that we were making was I remember being in College Station, Texas, when the energy plan came out, and the College Station Eagle wrote about the energy plan. I mean, it was in the paper, and the author of that was Terry Hunt of Associated Press. So here you have the College Station Eagle depending on somebody who's not 100 yards from the Oval Office. And that is always going to, that's been the case, and it continues as much as the Ford administration, Nixon administration, Carter, all of them were interested in the out-of-town press, that for really the definition of what's happening in a White House, that is that White House press corps that's right there. So I was surprised by that quote from Mark McKinnon, but I thought it's a fun one to deal with anyway. In looking at your role, it seems that you have more flexibility than a lot of White House reporters do, because you have that your column that you can write about. To what extent do you get to do whatever you really are interested in doing?
Well, through that column, I do. I mean, it was, I don't understand how, I mean, I'm really glad I have it. You know, I mean, it's hard, you know, because it ruins my weekends. I have to come up with an idea every week. But it's a great, I'm given more voice in that than I get in the newspaper. I mean, I sometimes find that, you know, after writing one of those, I then write a news story with a little more life to it, and it always gets taken out. Then I just put it in the column on, But the idea came from, of all people, Hal Raines. I mean, it was during the, when we were running the, when we had the Nation Challenge section that we ran after the, during the, after September 11th and during the war in Afghanistan. We had a lot of pages to fill, and as the war was winding down, that we had less, it was harder to fill that section, you know. And so Hal said, would you like to write this thing on Mondays for the Nation Challenge, and we'll put it on the second page. And so I did that. And then Johnny Apple, another, you know, really illustrious Times reporter, also wrote, he wrote a letter from Washington. I did White House letter, and he did a letter from Washington. And anyway, after the section stopped, you know, early 2002, I guess it was, or late, they said, do you want to keep it going? And I said, yeah. I said, but I don't want to do it Mondays because it ruins my Sunday. They said, no, you have to do it Monday. So I don't know. So I do it Mondays, and it's, I kept it up.
How do you come up with ideas?
Well, it's hard. I mean, sometimes I'm Friday. No, usually by Friday, I have to know what's going on because I have to do the reporting for it. Before the weekend, it's very hard to reach people on a weekend unless it's a major news story, you know. I don't know. I mean, today's Monday. I'm not worrying too much about next week's, but I start worrying on Tuesday. I try and do stuff that's topical. It's off the news. I mean, I realize it's important real estate in the New York Times. I mean, it's, you know, it's in the back of the A section, but it's still the New York Times. And so I feel like I've been given this space. It's there no matter what. I mean, that's a great honor in a way in this business. So it better be good, you know. And so I better impart information. It better be stuff that is interesting that I work to get, and not just me sort of yammering on about something, you know. I feel that, you know, it has to have value. So I have some ideas for next week. I'm not sure. A lot of times I kind of wait to see how the week is shaping up, and sometimes I do it if there's a theme for the week. I mean, last week it was obvious it was time. The week before that it was Bush getting into the campaign. Sometimes I do it on a person, you know. It's hard to do 800 words, but I do it.
When thinking, you were talking about how hard it is to kind of get to the person of the president. One of the ways in the past that it's been important, an opportunity to get to who that person is as president, are presidential press conferences. What do you find their use are, the major uses are of the press conferences? And do you think that they should have more of them?
Here, do you want one of these? Well, sure, they should have more. Well, you know, I mean, I don't think press conferences tell you very much about that much about the president. I do think, what's their use? Their use is, making news. But I mean, I'm less. up in arms and my other colleagues at the White House about that there are not enough. I mean, there aren't enough, but I don't think that they tell you that much about the presidency. Uh-huh. I mean, they get you a page one story and they get some news, they drive some news, but uh-huh. that's usually because the White House wants to make news. I mean, the president is perfectly capable of getting up there and not making news. I mean, he knows what he's doing, uh-huh. you know, those press conferences. So I guess it's good for the public to get a look at the president and to see how he handles, you know, this president, especially the half of the country, you know, that doesn't support him, thinks that doesn't think he's very smart, you know. So I think it's good for him to get up there and answer questions in a live setting. I mean, I think he's quite good at it, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of those people who doesn't think I think he's quite smart. But I'm amazed when I, you know, talk to you. I mean, you must hear this yourself, you know, mm-hmm. that. So I think it's good to see the president in that setting, and you know, especially, you know, he had a press conference which right before the war started last year in early March, about a week or so before the war started, that I thought the White House press corps got trashed for that because we were perceived as lapdogs and much too easy on the president. And we can talk about that if you want to. But I think it was good for the country to see its leader standing up, you know, in prime time, live, taking questions when he was about to take us into war. I mean, that's mm-hmm. a good thing to it's a democracy. It's good to have that.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a perception.
That we can talk about it if you want. I have my own version of that. But
But in a way, it wasn't in your hands.
No.
You can ask questions, but how can you end up pressing a president to a point
that
he's going to give an answer that he doesn't want to give?
And you're completely at a disadvantage in those press conferences. There's just no way. He's got all the advantages of being the president, of having the sympathy of the audience, and. You can't push him too hard, or it becomes a story about you. Mm-hmm. As I've learned, I did I was a panelist in the Democratic debate up in New York, the last Democratic debate between four candidates left, Sharpton, Kucinich, Kerry, and Edwards, and I was told by CBS and the New York Times to be very aggressive and to interrupt, and we don't want to hear their stump speeches anymore. We want this lively. We want this New York. Well, you can't imagine the email I got about being obnoxious and overbearing and insulting and, you know, just I should be fired. And, you know, life goes on and, you know. But the point is I would never do that in a press conference. I mean, you just would be excoriated, and it wouldn't be about the president. It would be uh-huh. about you. Yeah. And so when we were so criticized for that press conference during the war, I mean, I was criticized actually for saying Mr. President. It was like, what am I supposed to call him? That's the uh-huh. what we do. But people were so hyped up about how polite we all were and how deferential. And I think the country was, there was such tension and anger in the country right before that war started, it all came out on us.
Uh-huh.
But I also think, I have to tell you, I think we were very deferential because, you know, in the East Room press conference, it's live, it's very intense. It's frightening to stand up there. I mean, think about it. You're standing up on primetime live television asking the President of the United States a question when the country's about to go to war. There was a very serious, somber tone that evening, and I think it made, and, you know, nobody wanted to get into an argument with the President.
Mm-hmm.
At this very serious time, and it had a very heavy feeling of history to it, that mm-hmm. press conference.
Yeah. Do you think that there is there's sometimes confusion about what role the press has, that people criticize
yeah.
the press in a sense as if the press is the opposition?
And so, as if we're the Democrats, right.
And,
yeah.
So in a lot of ways, I mean, they have, the Bush White House has benefited from not having a very effective opposition for a large amount of their presidency.
Right. I mean, now there's less of that, obviously, because they've got a really yeah. strong opposition in Kerry. But for, yes, especially for the war, John Kerry voted for the war. I mean, the Congress was largely behind the president for that war. And the people who were angry about the war felt – Yeah, you're absolutely right that it was they beat up on us. Why aren't you stopping this? So it's not my role.
Right.
You know, and I believe me, I saw what happens when you come on way too, you know, you come on too strong in a with a politician
mm-hmm.
on television.
Yeah. Well, one of the issues that's come up that we were talking about actually before our session began about the president is newspapers. Does he read newspapers?
Oh.
And so you have some people, you know, have been interviewed, staff people say, no, he doesn't read newspapers. And then in your interview with the First Lady, it seemed that maybe one of the points that they wanted to get across with that interview was the point that indeed they do read newspapers.
Maybe they did, but I have to say I asked that question as an afterthought at the end. Oh, by the way, as I was walking out, he reads the paper. Does he read the papers? And she said, you know, so this notion that she had planned to say that. I mean, I asked. I don't think she would have said it if I hadn't asked. I really think that because I was walking out.
Uh-huh.
And of course he reads the papers. He's always read the papers. I mean, before he was president, he read the papers. I know he reads the New York Times, and on every word, you can't actually read the New York Times and every word and be a productive member of society. You know, it's not enough time. But, I think he reads them like a lot of really busy people read them. I think in the morning he gets Mrs. Bush told me. I don't think I put this in the story. She said they get the New York Times, the Washington Post.
Wall Street Journal,
the Dallas, they get the Dallas paper, the Texas papers, they get them late, USA Today, the Washington Times, you know, the basic papers we all get in Washington. And they read them in bed with coffee, and then I think they read them over breakfast. And no, he doesn't read every story. I don't read every story. There's a lot of stories I don't have to read, you know. And a lot of times when he's given a speech, I don't think he would need to read that story. He knows what he said, you know, and maybe he's reading it for any kind of, you know, but I think what happened was, and Ari Fleischer always told me he read the papers, you know, and I used to be able to tell when Ari would call and say, you know, I used to call and say the president's really unhappy, this is wrong in your story, and it was like buried in the story. And I don't think Ari was making it up that the president was unhappy. I don't think Ari would have bothered to call me about that. And I think that what happened was last summer, the president had a bunch of reporters over to the ranch at the end of the summer in Crawford. I wasn't there at this. I wasn't in this thing. But in that session or in this little barbecue, he told a bunch of reporters that he didn't read the papers. And I think he meant it like, you guys aren't that important in my life. You know, there's nothing you write that can tell me anything. And, you know, Mrs. Bush later backpedaled with me and said, well, what he meant was he doesn't read everything and he doesn't read the columnists, you know, the ones that are beating up on him, you know, and he, which may or may not be true, but I believe her. I believe Ari. I believe, it doesn't make sense that he doesn't read the papers. Maybe he reads them less now than he used to because he's got, you know, summaries and stuff.
How do you hear from the White House when the president's unhappy? You mentioned
you get
Ari
press
there.
Secretary calls or you, Scott will call.
Did they call you? Do they ever call your editor? Or they just call
They usually you? Call me, and then I don't think I'm trying to think what they usually call me and complain, and then you know, I'm trying to think if they've ever called the editor. No.
What kinds of things do they complain about?
Funny little things. They once got really mad about something I wrote about the president and God, and it was early on. It was after 9/11, and I made some comment that I thought I wrote something that I'd heard from a really good close friend that I can't remember how I phrased it, but it was something about how the president thought that God was testing him or something. It was a very mainstream thought. You know how you say that God never gives you more than you can, you know, how religious, you know, it's very standard. God doesn't give you more than you can handle or you know, God had given, it was pretty, I thought pretty, homogenized. I didn't think it was really out there. And, but the White House got so angry because they thought I was saying that Bush thought he was, you know, appointed by God or that, you know, God had, you know, it was, so they got very angry about that. Other things like, I mean, Scott got mad at me about something he said in a, the way I characterized something he said in a briefing. There was little, it's funny little things. One time I told you earlier, there was I did a story, and we wrote that, it was a double byline story, and the other reporter had written that the stock market went down after a presidential speech, but actually it went up. It was kind of a bad mistake. But since my name was first on the story, they came after me. And Scott was on my case because it was for a week for a correction. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty sure it wasn't just Scott driving that. You know, I think it just irritated. I don't know. Uh-huh. So that's how they tell you.
We'll have to see if we. I think maybe what we can do now is go into to questions.
Oh,
we can
okay.
get some questions from Calson.
You're all still awake. Oh, I'll get there. No one seems to have inspired. No one seems to have inspired any questions.
I was going to say yes, but before we do that, when you were covering in the Reagan administration, did you hear from people then?
I mean,
the White House?
Oh, yeah, they would complain.
Would they complain?
Yeah.
The same kind of thing?
Yeah, but not. I had no sense. I don't think Reagan read the papers, actually. I mean, I don't know about that, but I had no sense that he – I don't have at all the sense that he was as engaged – in the press give and take as Bush is. But you would hear more from the chief of, you know, the press people. They get very angry.
Do you hear from anybody other than
Dan calls to complain about stuff.
But you wouldn't hear from say, you know, other senior people like Andy Carr.
No, that would be beneath him to call and complain. You know, really.
Jim Baker, did Jim Baker do it?
I don't remember him doing it to me. Dick Darman really complained to me once. He was deputy chief of staff. He got very angry about something I wrote. But that was it.
What do you do when you get complaints from them?
Well,
how do you weather?
Well, I like to think that I'm not always as well behaved as I should be. You know, the best thing to say is to listen and let them vent and then just say, you know, you have a really good point and I take your point, but here's why I wrote that or whatever. And Scott was on me recently about a correction he wanted for some of the National Guard coverage. And it was actually, this was really about Scott. It wasn't about the president. And Scott was mad because I had written that he hadn't answered the question. And I can't remember now all the details, but he was angry that I hadn't. And I said, well, you didn't answer the question. And he said, well, that's just your characterization of it. You know, I answered it the way I wanted to answer it. So he sort of went round and around. And finally he, but I just said, Scott, I don't even know what I would write as a correction. I mean, there's no factual error here. He just didn't like the characterization of it. So I said, let me take it to the editors. So I took it to the editors, and I said, here's the transcript. Here's what I wrote. I don't think it needs a correction. And I told Scott, you know, they're taking a look at it. I was really nice, and we'll get back to you. And actually, I never did. We just died. We never ran. It didn't deserve a correction at all.
One thing, and this is kind of often another another area, to get a sense of what the White House beat is like, to compare it with what other kinds of beats were, like when you were in India and when you were in Tokyo, when you were putting together daily journalism with enterprise reporting. How did you do that? What were some of the things?
In India and Japan?
Yeah.
Well, India and Japan were a little different because I was there on contract for the Washington Post, so I had very little – I didn't really have much daily responsibilities. It was very, I mean, I did really good stories there because I had a lot of time and I could, you know, take a week or two on a story and I traveled a lot. So, but I mean, I did do some spot news and so you just try and mix it up. You're always, you know, you cover the spot news because it happens, you can't control it. But while you're doing that, you're always working on a longer term project, which I kind of always am anyway. That's sort of how you do it, is if you cover a beat that you do the daily, but then you also have a you know, have a couple of longer term things in your pocket that you're working on. Mm-hmm. At any given time right now, I'm supposed to go to Fort Campbell, Kentucky with Bush on Thursday. I'm also worrying about, you know, shorter term project, which is what I'm supposed to write for my White House letter. Plus, I'm worrying about a story that the Times wants me to write for Wednesday. I don't know how I'm going to do it, about Bush and his transition to a candidate from president. And, there's two other things I'm working on. You know, it's just, they're always, I've got a lot of balls in the air at any given time.
Uh-huh. And that's probably more so than in other beats.
Right. It's much more so. It used to drive me crazy. I've just gotten used to it. When I was in the style section, I was always doing, you know, in the spot stories would be like parties or, you know, art openings or something. Plus, I was doing longer term profiles. And it was I would get very admired into a profile or to, you know, it would take 2 weeks or 3 weeks to do if it was a big, long profile of somebody. And it would be very hard to get out of that and do something else because my head would be in this direction. And I just have given up that. I don't have that luxury anymore. I'm just constantly pulled in all directions.
Uh-huh. And in a way, that mirrors what happens within a White House, that White House staff have to work on so many different things.
Right.
And it's also a no-mistakes kind of environment. You have a lot of different things to do, and you know that you can't make mistakes. At the same time, you know, people are going to. And so there's just an enormous amount of pressure. And so what that it usually ends up with for White House officials is not long tenure.
Right.
They say like right. Ari Fleischer. Well, what about reporting?
It's
in
the same
in a way. You have the same kinds of things.
It's the same thing. I mean, in the Clinton administration, the standard length of time for any Times reporter covering that White House is about 2 years, and people really burned out on that because partly it was just the hours, and the last few years the pressures of Monica Lewinsky and all that, but. It's certainly true of this beat, too. I find one of the hardest things is you're right, you can never be wrong. You can't make mistakes. And the range of topics that I have to know about covering the White House is just enormous. You know, well, you know what they are. It's all the domestic policy. It's theoretically every country in the world that we deal with, which is all of them. It's politics. It's economy. It's one thing after another. And a lot of times I get hit with them late in the day, and it's, you know, it's going on the front page of the Times, and it has to be right. And it just, you're right, the pressure is enormous, and it's also the hours.
What would be a typical, let's say a typical week of the kinds of hours? You know, how many days do you work during the week, and what do you start out doing? We have some sense, for example, I think of how White House officials begin a day and whatnot, but reporters, we don't have quite the same. What do you read in the morning, and when do you get up and the rest
of
it?
Oh, you know, you want to hear all this boring. Right?
Yeah,
well, I've got two kids, so I'm up really early. But, let's see. Usually our days start later, the office in the White House does. I mean, we're always a couple of hours behind the administration because they have to do their thing first, and then we have to find out, then we have to cover it, right? But I'm up really early. I'm up around 5:30 because I go to the gym or I run, and then I have kids I have to get to school. So by the time I get to the office, I've been up for five hours. You know, it's just the whole day's gone. So, today I got in by – I was up at 5:30, and then I came home by, 7. I went to the gym, and then I came home by 7, and then I had to – make lunches and drive the carpool for middle school, and then I had to come back, and I have a live-in nanny, so I shouldn't complain too much. And then I had to get the other, my son, she actually got him breakfast because I was away driving the carpool. And then my husband's in India. He covers Colin Powell. That's the problem. I am a single parent this week. Mm-hmm. Normally I have help at home with another person. He also works for the Times. So what happened? Then I had to walk Teddy to the bus stop, and then I came back, and then I drove to the office. And then
Would you have read the papers?
I haven't read the papers.
Uh-huh.
So where did I read the papers in there? Nowhere, right? That's what I mean. I think, I feel for the president, right? So I know how to read the papers. I know to look at, at the health club, I was watching CNN, so I knew that there was no disaster. You know, that's my main thing, is you don't want to go into the White House or the office with, you know, a huge news story and be totally oblivious to it. It's a bad idea. But I knew from CNN watching it, you know, with the crawl, that there was nothing going on.
Uh-huh.
So, or nothing much. I knew that the big story was going to be, was going to be Spain. You could tell that this was a big, which we had already. We had, David had the story this morning, David Sanger, saying that this was a big problem for Bush had just lost a big ally. And then there was a, there was supposed to be, usually on Mondays there's a 9:30 foreign policy meeting at the office where we all talk about what we're doing that week on foreign policy. And there's a 10 a.m. Domestic policy meeting. I go to both because, you know, all the, the three White House correspondents go to both. We're the only ones who do. And but meanwhile, that was late, so then I went over to the White House for Scott's early gaggle at 9:45, which was an hour late today. Scott has been running really late, his early briefing. So I guess that's when I read the paper. You know, everybody was complaining. I thought, great, now I can read the paper.
Yeah, so and that's true with a lot of people. You see a lot of people reading
So I sat there and I read the paper, and that, that solved that problem. And then Scott had his gaggle, and I went back, and I was not. I was hoping not to write a story today because I was coming here, and it's hard to get out at 5:30 if you're writing a story. And I saw instantly that I could avoid writing a story if I, because I saw that there was a, Scott had said a couple, he'd really trashed Kerry today, which was interesting. He did that from the podium. And after saying for weeks that he was not going to make, you know, political statements from the White House, there he was. So I knew that would go into somebody's story, but it wasn't a story on my own. Because, and then the other thing was, there was, he said stuff about Spain, and that was would go into another story, so, or maybe the same story. So I just fed those quotes to other reporters in the office working in those stories. Then I started working on this other thing about the president and his candidate, which they won in 48 hours. I don't see how they're going to get it, but that's what they want. And then I came here. I mean, that's sort of semi-typical. If I'm writing, I'm there much later. The deadline is theoretically 6:30 for a story, but depending on how big it is, it can go to 7:30 or 8. So I get home oftentimes at 8:30 or 9. We have dinner very late. We call we call ourselves the Spanish family of Bethesda because, you know, I'm the only fourth grader who eats dinner at 9. But we, you know, the kids like to have dinner with us. So so that's my life. And that isn't, if it was a travel day, you know, it means I get up at early. I mean, sometimes it's 4. My record is 3:30 because I have to be at Andrews Air Force Base so early to fly out either with the president or usually on the press charter. And then, you know, you cover the president on a travel day and then you're back at sometimes early, sometimes 11
and then you
at
work
night.
On the weekend too.
Right. I work every Sunday because I write the column. So I work a minimum of 6 days a week. And it kills me when I have to work Saturday. Like now with the way the schedule is for the Times, we have the Sunday paper has they've expanded the circulation and the reach of the Sunday paper. As a result, if you want, if the Times, since the Times is now delivering to smaller and smaller cities around the country on Sunday morning, the first deadline for the, that edition, it's called the Bulldog, I don't know why, is 9 a.m. Saturday. So it's really grim when I have had a really long week and then I have to write a Sunday story that I haven't written. And I've had a pleasant Saturday mornings where I'm up at 5 a.m. again to write a story for a 9 a.m. deadline. And then they, and then if there's, they, it often will be updated during the day for a 3 o'clock deadline. You know, so, you know, there, it's possible to very easily work 7 days a week. That's why people burn out.
One can certainly see that. Plus, you're writing about so many different types of topics.
Plus, the, we haven't even talked about the issue of my my competitors, the Washington Post. They had a great page one on Saturday. I mean, I was thinking, you know, and so then you've got that problem, which is the Post has had this and we didn't have it. So you've got that pressure on you, not just the ways. I mean, I don't work in a, in this vacuum. I work with a lot of competition, you know, but and then happens, the editors get upset.
That happens to a lot of other people. They say, well, you know, the Times has, has this.
But it happens to us a lot, you know. I mean, unfortunately, and the Saturday was a really bad day. The Post had a lot of good stories. And they get, you know, I don't know. I don't know how our editors are not relaxed about that. It's part of the thing of the Times that we should have every story. I don't know how much the Post gets in trouble if we have a story that they think they should have. I don't have a sense that it's as bad over there when they miss a story. We'll find it. You should ask them.
Okay. Well, I see. Larry had Larry had a question. Larry's the director of the Washington Center. He's a political scientist who writes about decision making. He's written about Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam.
Spending all my time answering questions from reporters on Vietnam and Iraq. So, but I'm not going to ask that question. So I wanted to talk about the president as candidate for a second. This has been a great interview. And as I emailed Martha on Sunday night, I thought your piece on Sunday in the Times was just fantastic.
Oh, thanks. The negative. Another reason to be driven mad. That was, you know, they were torturing me until 11 o'clock at night on that one.
But
Friday.
On the president as candidate, this morning I heard Evan Thomas and Don Imus talking about Mrs. Bush being very upset at, and actually at the committee, that the president's reelection committee's inability to basically present the president as a human being, their inability of the to get the message of who the president is out there, and they're very concerned about the way it's looking right now. And I was struck by two things you said today. I've been struck by a lot. Everything you said has been really interesting. But you, like four of my friends who have gotten to know the president, have said...
I can't tell you I know that. Well,
but when they have met him...
Yeah, I've met him. Yeah, of course.
When they have
met talked
him,
to him.
They all come away with the following impression. He's a lot brighter than anyone thought he was.
Absolutely, yeah.
He's very engaging.
Right.
He's very personable.
Right.
He can have conversations with people. Yet, as you note, this is a White House that can't get off their talking points, doesn't let you really get to know the president, and is basically too controlled. And I'm wondering, do you think this can last? Who's calling the shots here? Do you think the president is actually aware of the fact that no one's getting to know him, unless you can go into the White House and talk to him?
There was a story in Time. Was that in Newsweek this today that Laura Bush is upset about the campaign? It was in Time because Evan Thomas works for Newsweek, right? But he was talking about the Time story. That's interesting. I didn't actually see it in Time. I read that story today, and it was mostly about Barbara Bush. Are we sure it was? I was looking for it because I saw it. It was mentioned. They were both upset. Well, I have some reporting to do. I spoke to her, and I had this. So what do I think? I think the president is calling an awful lot of shots with this campaign. All the major decisions are being made by Bush. And, you know, when I say that, people are stunned. I mean, you don't sound like you are, but people are stunned, you know. But he learned at the knee of, you know, Lee Atwater. Let's not forget the take no prisoners political operative for his father. And that's a really interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. Do I think that the president is concerned that people don't know who he is or whatever? No, I don't think he is. Now, but that's the kind of thing a wife worries about, you know. Laura Bush, when I talked to her, the most interesting thing she said was I asked her if she thought that Karl Rove's role was overstated, Karl Rove being the, you know, very powerful, you know, political advisor to the president. And she said, yes, but Karl likes that. And it was a real dissing, you know.
It was, yeah.
I mean, it was like, whoa. And I made sure when I did that interview, that was on the front page part of the New York Times. I mean, that was like, I mean, I almost wanted to lead with it, but I didn't. I don't know if Bush is concerned about it. Obviously, I guess his wife is. Mike Devers said to me that he thought that the White House, he was Reagan's guy, and he was the master, the communicator that created the sort of Reagan staging that was so brilliant. And he said that he thought that their control has hurt, you know, has kept the real George Bush from coming out. Because you're absolutely right. Most reporters of the White House like the president. I mean, personally, it's impossible not to, you know. And when I say this to Democrats, they get all upset and angry, and said, you know, he's very Clinton-like in his charm, and in some ways he's in, you know, one-on-one, he's in some ways better than Clinton because he's in a funny way more humble, you know, personally. Maybe he doesn't really think that, but when you meet him, he's you know, he's a very gifted politician. There's no question about it. And in crowds, he's terrific too. You know, big rooms, big crowds, he's great. And he's one of the best I've ever seen. You know, he's only gotten better too in the last couple of years. So I don't know if that answers your question, but what I've done for me is realize I have many more calls to make tomorrow. You know, story.
In part, do you think it's a difference between campaigning and governing? That in governing, what you're trying to do is put out your brand of leadership, which is going to be your policy initiatives,
right,
and what your goals are. And that's what they focused on from the time that they've gotten there. And then in campaigning, the person of the president becomes important.
Yeah, that's, and I think, let's see what happens. Maybe this will be a shift or something. He's very happy right now, people say, you know, in combat, and, you mm-hmm. know, in the political combat. And he likes this a lot. And I'm all for, you know, I mean, it's so frustrating for me to write about mm-hmm. this White House. I mean, George Bush is actually quite interesting. You know, I think the view of the country after he became president was he was just, again, this sort of shallow, not very interesting guy. But he's more interesting to me now than he ever was, you know, 3 years ago because mm-hmm. of the way all the things that he's been through, and just there's much more complexity in his personality than, I mean, as there is with anybody, you know, once mm-hmm. you get into it.
But in a way, they have tried to increase, well, from not yeah. very many, relatively, increase the number of opportunities that he's had from time to time with reporters. For example, I'm thinking of the Air Force One. The times on Air Force One,
yeah.
when he's been coming back from trips.
But it's
from
been
trips.
twice.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, one of them was, I think the first one I remember, the first one
Middle
was
East.
After Aqaba, yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, there was this moment of euphoria that he had achieved this, uh-huh. you know, this sort of, this breakthrough with the Palestinians and the Israelis. And so he was just, I think he just... and I was not on that pool, in that Air Force One pool, but he mm-hmm. called reporters up to the conference room, and you could see his mind working. I mean, that mm-hmm. transcript was long. It was a lot of it was repetitive, yeah. but you could see him engaged. It was really interesting.
Uh-huh.
And the same thing happened after the secret Baghdad trip.
Uh-huh.
He was called up. And that was uh-huh. less about policy and more just an excited person talking about this uh-huh. you know, this secret thing he pulled off.
Yeah, and then there was the tour that he took through the through his property. You remember that, where he was talking for a couple of hours?
That was a Christmas walk or something, wasn't it? Was that last?
It was some while. I was thinking of one that was in the summer. In fact, it might have been that first summer. But you got a real sense of what he enjoyed and what he enjoyed about Texas.
When you talk to him, he's like talking to, you're talking to a normal person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the other thing, the problem I have is he was my husband's classmate at Yale, so he's my husband's age. And I mean, just for me, it's more, I mean, I never forget he's the president, but it's also he's a more familiar than he might be, you know. So not that they were very good friends or anything. But anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Towson.
A quick question. I was wondering, do you think it would be possible that your job would have been more exciting maybe 30 years ago, when presidents were more arguably accessible in a non-formal way, and also maybe you wouldn't have as much of a pressure, editorial pressure, what you can write and what are the deadlines?
Can you lean forward towards your microphone more, because you're breaking up?
Is this better?
Yeah.
A little bit. Get farther down if you can.
Okay, so my question is, I'm trying to speak slowly so you can
hear
better.
That's much, much better.
My question is, do you think your job might have been more exciting about 40 years ago, when the White House was arguably less closed than today's administration,
yeah.
and where president was being met in a less formal environment, and also where maybe the pressure from the editors and the deadlines you mentioned would have been smaller?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know. I'm sure the pressures were there, very intense back then, 40 years ago. That was only Well, that was only the 1960s. That was Kennedy. I'm actually, you know what? I can tell you, my uncle, Frank Cormier, may he rest in peace, senior White House correspondent.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, and he was in Dallas when the president was shot. So 40 years ago, it was not that much different from now, except that it wasn't a 24-hour news cycle. But there were, I think Kennedy was more accessible. He created the first, he had, you know, terrific relations with the press. He's famous for that. He started the White House News Conference. I mean, if you want to go back, you know, to the time of FDR, maybe that would have been a very exciting time during the Second World War to cover the White House. And you do see pictures of again, reporters with FDR. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it would have been easier. I think it's just impossible today to think that there would be the press. There's too many reporters. It's too big. It's too much of a monster now for it to be the way it was in the old days.
Yeah, and there was so much pressure during going back and reading Roosevelt press conferences. In one of them, Roosevelt asked, I think it was Robert Nixon. It was either Robert Nixon or Doug Cornell, if it was true that the day before, because they were both wire service reporters, I can't remember which one it was, but whether he had, it's true that he had written 15,000 words the day before, because it was a huge news story. I don't remember what it was.
And oh, my God. 15,000.
So Helen was talking about Doug in a time when he dictated for an hour and a half. And so there have always been lots of pressures. Even at the time of William Price, I was looking for, I was going back in the Evening Star and looking for a White House reception, the January 1st reception, and what had happened in that reception. And so I looked at the January 2nd, the 3rd, and I couldn't find it. And then I went back and looked at January 1st. And because it was a PM paper, that they had a report on what the reception was that morning at the White House.
That was a fast turnaround.
So that is really a fast turnaround, yeah.
Well, my uncle, you know, when he was covering the White House, there was no, it was the 60s, but there were no computers. They were still typing on manual typewriters. If you want to see something funny, that fabulous book, The Boys on the Bus by Timothy Krause, it still, mm-hmm. it holds up. I read it. It's about the 72 campaign. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're all lugging around portable typewriters, you know, manual typewriters. My uncle used to dictate off the top of his head. He never wrote anything down. That was what really good wire service reporters could do in those days. And the reason I even know this, because I was in elementary school in the 60s, was Jim Gerstenzang, who from the L.A. Times, he's left the White House speeches recently, but he, the first couple of years of this administration, he was covering the White House for the LA Times. He worked with my uncle, and he would tell me these wonderful stories about, you know, my Uncle Frank, you know, just sort of flipping through his old, you know, reporter's notebook and just dictating into the phone, cradling it in on his shoulder, dictating into the phone in perfect sentences with perfect punctuation. And then when the story was done, he would just throw the notebook over his shoulder into the wastebasket. You know, it's great image of, you know, because he said he never saved anything. Dictating off the top of your head in perfect sentences is really hard, uh-huh. you know.
And he talked. I interviewed him.
Frank.
And Frank. And one of the things I remember is his story of the difficulties of dealing with Lyndon Johnson.
Right.
That Johnson was a president who could complain, and so Johnson had complained about a story that in wire service reporting, they're it's spare. It's
right.
It's pretty clean. You don't have often you don't have a lot of reaction. But anyway, Johnson had been upset about one of his stories, and it must have been around Christmas time. Because he said at Christmas, Johnson used to give reporters presents. And so that particular Christmas, it was a tie clasp with a presidential seal on it. And he said he opened his box, and he said it was empty. And he said he knew that was Johnson. Wow. But on the other hand, he said that when his parents had come into town, that Johnson had heard that and that he gave them a tour. And he said, you know, the president could be a couple of different things. So that, you know, you knew him, you saw him a lot more, but it wasn't necessarily good what you heard from him. You could feel his anger. It wasn't just the staff. It was the president who got after you.
Yeah.
Hi, Ms. Bowmiller. Thank you for coming here. I'd like to add that I have added your New York Times website to my favorites page.
So. Oh, thank you. I can't claim any credit for that. But it's a really good website, though.
Yeah, obviously.
They do a really good job with it.
My question is actually a two-part question. Do you feel with the recent elections in Spain that this will change? I came in late, so I don't know.
Yeah, that's, I haven't talked about that yet.
That if you feel that some of our allies will readjust their positions, their allegiance to America and the reconstruction of Iraq. And also, if you, I took a class with Professor Robert Chauvin, and he was talking how this summer, obviously, because it's an election year, that'll be important to kind of politics, but that the Olympics being the summer that the whole world is watching, you know, obviously in Athens, and anti-Americanism will rise even more than it was over the last 4 years during the Bush.
those are good questions. I can't really answer them. I can't. There was a big the briefing I said a little earlier was the White House briefing was dominated today by questions about Spain, and the question was, how much of a problem is the loss of this ally for the Bush administration? And they won't answer it, you know, because there's really no answer they can say publicly, which is they can't, you know, malign another democratically elected government, you know, and so they can't say this is a problem for us. But obviously they're really concerned about it. I mean, their view privately is that the terrorists won, because what they wanted to do was use terrorism to affect political change, and so they got, and it worked, okay? And so I think the Bush administration is really concerned about this. Now, it's more symbolic than anything else. There's only 1,300 Spanish troops in Iraq, so pulling them out is not going to make a huge difference to what we do there. As for the Olympics, that's a really good question. I don't know. I think the other really big concern, obviously, is terrorism in Athens, and, you know, that's a very worrisome, given, you know, that, I mean, I guess they're doing everything they can, but it's nerve-wracking to think about it. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Towson? Do we have a question from Towson?
I've got a quick question about, could you talk a little bit about Jason Blair and what that has meant to you as not only a Times reporter, but as a reporter in general?
Yeah. All right. Well, I hardly knew Jason. I knew him to say hello to. Well, obviously, it turned the, I mean, I, there's nothing I can say that's that startling to you. It turned the paper upside down and was a terrible, terrible period in the paper's history. And it affected all of us in a big way. I think, our executive editor, you know, it just turned the paper upside down. I have a lot of new editors now as a result. I mean, they were there before. Howell left and Gerald Boyd left and. But it was a really it was a hard time to work at the paper in that last spring when this was going on. There was about 5 or 6 weeks between the time that Jason first came out that he had plagiarized this story, and then it was like this house of cards, and it was just this. So it was hard to work at the paper. It was hard to concentrate. I don't think the paper was at its best. I certainly think the Washington Bureau was particularly hard hit because it had been. There had been so much animosity between the Washington Bureau and Hal Raines, and so it was a relief when it all settled down, basically this summer and then finally this fall. and all the new people were in place. But I think, and I don't mean this is kind of like, you know, White House spin, but I do think it, there were a lot of good reforms that were started at the paper because of Jason Blair. They're never going to stop us from having another Jason Blair, but there's a much more stringent sourcing policy now, which drives me crazy, but we do it. You know, you now have to tell one editor who the source is, who the Republican supporter of the president is, you know, and I mean, I've never made anything up, you know, but now it's good that it's there, you know, that they asked us to do it. I mean, I had to file a story last night, which was in the paper today, and there's a Republican supporter of the president there quoted. Well, last night at home, I got a call from the editor saying, Elizabeth, you've got to tell me who this is under our new policy. And I said, oh, okay. You know, so I told her, you know, I don't know what that does, but I guess it keeps a lot of people more honest, you know. You know, I think it's good. I mean, what it has done is it's unleashed, practically speaking, externally, it's unleashed a huge amount of animosity towards the Times, so that I think people get angrier. I mean, people who don't read the Times often decide, you know, write in and complain about it, and they don't know what they're talking about. But I think the Times became a whipping boy. It just became this lightning rod for a lot of criticism of the press in general. The Times is a really good paper. It's made up of people who work really hard, who are honest, who try and get things right. I mean, but it's hard to, a lot of people don't, there's people out there who don't think that.
Is there another Towson?
Yes. Is that Towson?
No. We're going to do Roger. Okay.
Do you find with the 24-hour news cycle that some of your stories get away from you with news happening so quickly, and it's often over before it's almost started?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, those of us, most reporters at the paper still are focused on the paper. You know, we've got a website, and that moves all the time. But there isn't a huge amount of pressure on us to write for the website. They have that has its own staff, because whether or not this will change, I don't know. But right now, in 2004, the focus is still on making that paper that comes out every morning really terrific. And so my focus is still on every 24 hours I have to produce something. And if at 8 o'clock, you know, I mean, it should be done by 7:30, 8 o'clock, they put it up on the website, that's fine. But I didn't have to do extra for that. You know what I mean? So, but I do think, yeah, things move, I guess they move faster. You know, I don't, you know, some reporters really like to write for their websites. I'm still focused on just getting a really good story in the paper and not just getting something in fast. I mean, sometimes what they'll do is that the Times, we have to write by 3 o'clock, if we have to write a summary of what our story is going to say for the next day. And I find that horrible, because a lot of times you don't know, you know, half the people you want have tried to call, haven't called back. But sometimes now what they'll do is they'll take that summary, which is just, it traditionally has been an internal, you know, 300 or 400 words that the editors carry into the page one meeting to decide if it's good enough to go on page one. And that sometimes they'll slap that up on the website, but they only do it if you give them permission, you know. And that's a little alarming when you're just cranking something out and all of a sudden, I mean, I sometimes it's happened where I haven't known it's gone on the website. I remember I got a call, I wrote something just, you know, you write these things like in 5 minutes, you know, they're not great, you know, they just, you're just telling the editors, here's what I got. And one time a couple summers ago, they slapped one up on the website, and I didn't know it, but I then knew it because a White House person called and started complaining about it. And I said, what are you talking about? And it was up on the website, and there was a mistake in it, you know, because I wasn't, and so, I mean, that kind of stuff happens, you know. Mm-hmm. But I'm not driven like, I notice a lot of my colleagues are much more 24 hours than I am. You know, it depends on their metabolism. The TV people are much more driven by it than I am. Mm-hmm.
would you say in reporting a story from the White House during the Reagan period and then now, would you say that the elements of a story are pretty similar?
Yeah. I mean, stories are always stories. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a kind of basic thing you do as a reporter. You do it in, I mean, I've noticed you kind of do it in any country of the world. You do it in almost any situation. I mean, if you know, and
what do you look for?
Well, you look for conflict. You know, mm-hmm. that's what we're about. We're not, you know, contrary to the White House. You know, we're not supporting John Kerry. We're supporting conflict. You know, that's what we do. I mean, it's not a story that you know that you know it's what we do, and so that's where our bias is. If you're looking for, you know, divides between members of the administration or problems, what we cover is problems, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the Spanish election was a news event, but to the extent that it's a story here, it's a problem for the administration. Uh-huh. You know, just like last week we covered Raimondo, the job czar I talked about earlier, who got undercut by the Kerry campaign.
Uh-huh.
You know, so that's where our bias is.
Is that, in a sense, that looking for conflict is looking for their soft points of looking
and that's why they
political problems.
Yeah, that's why they don't like the press, because it's our job is to, you know, we're not, you know, we generally don't write stories saying that everything was great at the White House today and, you know, this worked and that worked. I mean, that's a given. We look for, but I mean, you know, so... yes, we're looking for their vulnerabilities, and of course they hate that.
Mm-hmm.
Why shouldn't they?
George Reedy once said that presidents don't have press problems. They have political problems. They often think that they're press problems, and they treat it that way and will go after reporters. But in reality, what they are political problems.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. I don't think the White House is a press problem at all. I think we could be a lot tougher on them.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, they're getting a rough ride now because of Kerry, but that's because there's a natural mm-hmm. daily conflict. Uh-huh. It's, you know, it's right there on your email every day. There's, you know, dueling emails from the Bush campaign and the Kerry campaign all day long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gives you a headache.
And in a way, you can see things come into the briefing room. From the campaign,
right,
and it comes into the briefing room, and then it's in the briefing room. Then obviously it's going to be part of a story. One of the things that it seems to have happened over the years is that that White House staff people, after they leave, they go out into that political world, and they go out with the sophistication that they learned in the White House. So in a way, a White House has to keep ratcheting it up in order to keep. Current with all of the people who are out there who know how to impact a White House story, how to get into a White House story.
Right. I think that's what you're seeing with the Kerry campaign. Well, they are also a lot of them are veterans of past Democratic campaigns. I should have put this in the paper. Somebody told me something so funny the other day that a lot of the Kerry people are from the Dukakis campaign, and mm-hmm. the rap on Dukakis is now that he didn't answer all the negative attacks and that he should have, and these guys have learned their lesson, and you know, they're like, you know, the people who, you know, walked home from the Civil War without their shoes and never again, you know, and so they will never let a single charge go unanswered, and they haven't.
Uh-huh.
You know, accounts for the, you know, tenor of the campaign so far.
Well, one last question, Towson, do you have one last one?
Is that a person there moving towards the microphone? No.
I wonder if you think Kerry's gotten a free ride yet far. You hear people arguing that Bush is having a rough road and Kerry hasn't gotten really scrutinized by the press.
Well,
I was wondering what you thought of that.
That's certainly what the White House thinks. I think he did to some degree, because there was nine guys and now nine, you know, people. And I think now he's beginning to get some scrutiny. I thought we had a pretty interesting tough story on him today. Jody Wilgren had a really good story about him saying that, I don't know exactly what he said. There's some debate about what he actually said, but we reported that, you know, he had said that foreign countries or foreign leaders, mm-hmm. you know, unnamed, were hoping he would win. And so, and then he kind of waffled on it. And she wrote a really good, tough story. And because he's refused to name who these people are. And she also noted that he hadn't been overseas since 2002. So they must have told him it all before he ran for president. So I guess they told him in phone calls. I don't know. But
email.
Your email or something. Yeah, we don't know who they are. And the White House, you know, just came roaring back today and said, well, he better name them or he's just that, or the only alternative is to think that he's making it up to attack the president. It was pretty tough. Scott said that. So I think he's getting a lot more scrutiny now, and it's really early. I mean, we've done some stories about his Senate record, but there's going to be endless, I promise you, stories looking at him in a really tough way. But he's only been the presumptive nominee for what is his third week? We're only in the third week of this thing.
Yeah.
It's Monday, you know, the third week.
That's right. And we have 240 some days to go.
Yeah.
It's going to be long.
Yeah.
A long, long, tough campaign, as you pointed out on Sunday with the negative campaigning. Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.